Hey, kids, this is Mark Arm from Mudhoney.
This is Nicole Alvarez from the world-famous K-Rock.
Hey, I'm James Joseph from James and the Cold Gun.
Hey, I'm Zozier.
Hey, this is Jeremy Toback from the band Brad.
Hi, I am Matt Vaughn from Easy Street Records.
This is Josh Evans.
This is Charles Peterson.
And this is the State of Love and Trust.
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 A Pearl Jam podcast.
Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. Feed the algorithm.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The State of Love and Trust. It's a Pearl Jam podcast, and one of your two hosts, Jason Carapesi, and alongside me, as always, is...
Paul Guillieri.
Paul, we had a hell of a time last week talking Side A of Dark Matter, and today we get to finish the job.
We sure do. Cannot wait. Back nine, always more fun, huh? Golf analogy.
Is it?
Yeah. Usually. I mean... Trying to find your stroke in the beginning, you know, and then you
that's true. Hit the back. That's true. Especially if you're the kind of golfer that needs those beer muscles, you know, the car curl rolls around, you get a couple in you, like, all right, you start feeling loosey-goosey.
I'm the kind of golfer who gets lucky when it goes straight, Jason. So hopefully, hopefully this review will be straight.
Well,
let's put it that way.
I'll tell you what. Last week, Side A, episode 206, go check that out if you haven't. I poured myself a nice home pour of wine. Today, ooh, I'm going with Japanese whiskey, Paul. What do you got?
Oh, well, look at us. Look at us, huh?
Yeah.
Look at us. Who would have thought? Not me.
Is that a throwback from like episode like 2 or 3 weeks ago? That's a 200th episode callback for all those who don't know. Anywho, welcome to the show. We're glad you're here. Again, I am Jason. That is Paul. And before we kind of get into this, a few news and notes. If you would like to help support the show, you can always buy a t-shirt that we have on screen right now, one of these three items, or you can sign up for Patreon, where we do a lot of extra content, including video and audio only stuff, and a monthly giveaway. Last month's giveaway was the full LP for Dark Matter, and we're going to say who won that at the end of the episode, so stick around. So they call it tease, Paul.
It is a tease. It's good. It's the only way to keep people here long enough to hear the gibberish that's about to come out of my mouth. So
mine. Yeah, I think you said me wrong. This month's giveaway, May's giveaway, is what I'm wearing. This hat, the Dark Matter hat. So you can win that if you're a patron. We will select that at the very end of May, and it could be yours. So there you go.
Who doesn't want a hat that is soaked in Jason's scalp sweat? Please.
Oh, yeah. It's actually my hat. It's not like a clean new hat. It's this particular hat. I'll sign it and everything. No, just kidding. It's a new hat. It's in a box right over there. Anywho, if you are watching on YouTube, please go ahead and like and subscribe to the channel. Hit the bell for notifications. Helps other Pearl Jam fans, music fans find this content. We really do appreciate it. If you are old school, though, listening audio only, Paul, what should they do?
Well, they should rate, review, and subscribe on their preferred podcast platform of choice. Feed that algorithm. It's hungry this time of year.
In almost every time of year, really, if we're honest.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Now, insatiable appetite.
I did put it out there over the last few weeks that we were going to really up the ante, really reward people who wrote in reviews. And we have two winners, as I said, and that is for the Mojo magazine. The Pearl Jam, the Dark Matter slip mat, which by the way has this really cool design on the back, courtesy of our friend Alex Gnezdilov, and the In Stores Now poster. Two people
got those. What a haul!
I know, right? What a haul! Those two people, their usernames at least on Apple Podcasts were C Tardif 10 and Tommy Costas. So if one of those names is you, Paul's very excited for you.
Get
in touch and we'll hook you up with your stuff. Now, I want you to think about the fact that this is going to be a long one. Now, again, I referenced the home pour. We're going to be here for a while. Not only are there 6 songs instead of 5, but Paul, there was a big response to our divided opinion on Won't Tell. So it got me thinking I need to give a couple of new thoughts on that track before we kick into side B. Is that okay?
Yeah. Okay. I think you should. I think you should. You should atone for your sins, Jim. No,
atone. I'm dialing the atone phone for all my Colbert enthusiasts. It's a deep cut reference. Anyways, won't tell. So initially, despite Jeff saying that the lyrical themes of this song came from a dream he had about Joni Mitchell and Neil Young, which Ed fine-tuned, I couldn't link the passages. After you explained what you believe to be the story, unrequited love, or at least someone who's completely taken by another, but knows they cannot have them, and then vows to never let anyone know how they feel, it's an interesting story. And I think many of us have been there. I still think there are some missing lines, though, to connect the story. It feels almost like the best parts of this story are redacted or something. And I'm still not really a fan of the first half of the bridge lyrically. It's a little too on the nose for my taste, which, yeah, of course, you know, I said how I can't really deal with ambiguity. So, like, how do you please me? I understand. This is difficult. The ending still feels unfinished. Like, it needs something. Like a pretty mic solo, or I don't know, it just sort of ends. It sort of kind of just falls away. It doesn't really take me anywhere new when other outros on this record and in the catalog do that. So because of how you have communicated the intended story, and watching Jeff and Ed talk about it to Zane Lowe on Apple Music, I'm willing to move my grade up to a 3.
Stop the press.
I know it's only a half a point, but like, I still can't, but there's enough there to move it a touch. Your All response. Right.
My response is that, that is acceptable for now.
Oh, okay.
No, listen, I think that it's surprising to me that of all the songs on the record, this might be the one that is more polarizing than others. I didn't expect that. I honestly thought that of all the songs on the record, this one would be, is arguably the most radio friendly in a lot of ways. And I sincerely believe that it is, it's one of Jeff's finest achievements, actually. So, and we'll unpack that more as we get in, into some of these other songs, but.
Like a fine wine, it needs some air to really.
It'll age well.
Open up. So I'm thinking, like most songs do, and we'll talk about another song in this side B that needed a little bit of time for me to access it better. Some songs just need some time. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Side B, and on side A, you let off. So I'm going to flip it around like my hat, and I'll lead off this time around.
All right.
So we've got Upper Hand. Like digital water droplets dancing across a pond, Upper Hand begins, and this Inside Job length intro realizes the influence of Pink Floyd and U2 beautifully, which is really cool considering how the song evolves. This is arguably the most intense and tension-building intro they've done, and the aforementioned Inside Job is excellent, as we all know, as is the building wave and crescendo of Severed Hand. This particular wave doesn't crash with authority like Severed Hand does. It releases into a beautiful, serene inlet of classic Hendrix style accents that augment Stone's subtly affected rhythm guitar. I'm hearing reverb. I'm hearing tremolo from him. And you get the feeling you're like, you're underwater, but you're not fighting it, which I think is pretty cool. Meanwhile, Jeff and Matt are in lockstep, moving us from bar to bar as they tend to do. And the way the chorus, I should say the pre-chorus builds through the chorus, both Mike and Stone adopting a picking guitar lick with staccato breaks lifts us up out of the water, not unlike, and the metaphor surely isn't lost on Ed, a surfer finding a wave. Now, Matt, he's really riding that crash cymbal to fully realize the power of the chorus as well before we kind of retreat back into the water. And by the way, what a bridge solo from Mike. It's simple, but it evokes all the lessons learned from David Gilmour. So I love that.
Okay.
Also, the way that Matt plays the verse beat, you'd expect like a typical beat to have the snare hit on a 2 and 4, like 1 and 2 and 1 and 2 and or 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. But he plays it unevenly and he kind of skips the 4 and hits the 4 tom on the and between the 4 and the next measure is 1. It's kind of a unique way to move from bar to bar. And yeah. If anyone out there is a drummer, I'm curious what you guys think about this, and please correct me if I've not explained that correctly. So another great thing about the song, though, is that it's basically a 3-act play. So you've got this mm-hmm. brilliant, moody intro, right? And a bluesy, anthemic middle section. And then we get this outro that is, I mean, it's just beautiful. Ascending guitar chords. And yeah. Ed lifts us onto the biggest wave yet. And then double time and a fun, bright guitar solo from Mike that quickly becomes a bit of a melter. I can see this song going on an extra minute live, so that's great. Now, lyrically, right out of the gate, wow. I mean, the distance to the end is now closer than it's ever been. Talk about a reality gut punch right out of the gate. I know I'm not that old, but it feels real. Like, Ed's now got me thinking about my own mortality, and that makes me think about how much my back hurts, which is right now. But I have to say, I think many people feel like they've worked hard their whole life, personally, professionally, or both. And to feel like what they do and who they are has made a difference, that their individual skill set and character have made a positive impact on others, I think that's what we all want. And I think I can speak for both of us when I say that that's one of the goals of this show. So to hear Ed paint that picture, like the pages in the book he references, it's another one of those songs where it feels like Ed is singing directly to me. And those kinds of songs are special. So while I don't feel near the end of my life, a song like this reminds me to make the most of the time that I have, which still is plentiful. Mm-hmm. So while it may be morbid to some, I find it very uplifting. And the outro music kind of helps that feeling. You know, the final lines help to carry me home. Just need a few of you. It's a welcome admission that I'll probably need some help along the way. And I think that vulnerability and humility are clothes more people should wear. And we'll hear a little bit more about humility in the epilogue of our next song. Overall, it's fantastic. It's a 4.5 for me.
Wow. Is that the high watermark so far? And I think you had 1 4.5 on the
I think I had Scared of Fear at 4.5 as well.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Impressive. You know, when I first heard this song, my immediate reaction was Pearl Jam meets Streets Have No Name for the opening. Mm. I mean, you just get that U2 vibe there at the beginning, and then it's just Pink Floyd on cruise control. it's a soulful song. It really is. And I think it's going to shine in a live setting. And I imagine that it would shine in the Dolby Atmos mix. I didn't hear that, but this is the kind of song that I think would really play well.
Yeah.
With that mix in a large room. The intro for me, it really kind of captures that feeling of being disconnected. And so you get Stone's frenzied rhythm guitar, and it does a great job of manifesting that anxiety and that frustration that comes with being at odds with a loved one, and never really having that upper hand, you know? And the best way I could describe this song is this what irreconcilable differences sound like? As a composition, is this what irreconcilable differences sounds like? In the form of music. I think about the chorus. It kind of has like a Rocket Man feel to it, you know, a little bit of which kind of makes sense. Cause I mean, on Earthling, we had Elton John make a little cameo. So maybe that was fresh, you know, from those sessions. So, point out a couple of lyrics here to you, just like you did. So no room left on the pages. We filled them up and painted some, though the book, it may never be read. By anyone but me. There's that loneliness, that isolation that comes with accepting the end of something. Lonely ship on the horizon, silhouette fading out. That's how the song opens, right? Bright lights make for dark shadows. The lines once defined getting blurry now. In many ways, this song feels like it could be about the Beatles. I go back to, if you told me this entire song was about the Beatles, I would believe you. I really would. When you think about the journey of that band, how they slowly drifted apart, and what it was like recording Abbey Road, and you know, it I don't know. It's there's just so many parallels to it. I listen to these lines, and it's hard for me not to draw that conclusion. I'm not suggesting that is what the song is about, but I am saying that, you know, it'd be interesting if it was. I think it'd be a cool little backstory. The outro to me feels liberated with Mike's solo and just complete full sprint to that end referenced in the opening lyrics. So it's a big finish that I think is going to close a set at some point on this tour. I gave it a 4. I think
could open a set too with the opening.
It could. Yeah, it could. You know, it kind of has that pendulum thing going on where you could easily open a set with it. You could open a whole show with it. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they do. So yeah, it's a 4 for me. I think it's a fantastic song.
Excellent. Okay. We're pretty close on that one. Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, the time is here for Stip. Waiting for Stevie. Okay, here we go. A riff that Ed told Zane Lowe of Apple Music that he wrote back during the No Code sessions that by some force of nature, Andrew Watt had written like its blood relative and showed Ed while they were waiting for, as the story goes, Stevie Wonder, hence the title of the song. Like, talk about serendipity and talk about being thankful for Stevie Wonder being on his own timetable. You know, you've got a thick chorus affected riff that flows with an open D string and the melody bobbing around on that G string. Ryan Lynn showed us. It should be mentioned that to me, Jeff's bouncing bass line is as important to the nature of this as the guitar line. And then you've got Matt. He rolls the toms and we're into the main groove, and Ed joins shortly after in vintage form. The pre-chorus is the wall of guitar's sonic force we've grown to be obsessed with. Jonathan Cohen aligned it with Singles era Pearl Jam. I see where he's coming from, and this will apply twofold in the last half of the song. The interesting thing about the verses is they feel more like the chorus. The lyrics are similar, but the main hook of the song is there, not in the pre-chorus or chorus section. Now, the bridge is something that reminds me of Alive. It's a downshift, but it's still chocked full of tension, elevation, and dynamics. You know, you still feel the music pulling you towards something significant. You just don't know what. And then it hits you. Ed soars with the lyrics "For Her Love" right into the first beat of the next section, which is that beautiful opening riff, which somehow feels even more urgent than at the beginning of the song. And at first, you don't really know why, but you can feel it. It's bridging us to something new, something in the ascendancy. The way we feel at the apex of breath. So there it is, Cohen. Yeah. And that thing is arguably the best drum fill I've ever heard Matt Cameron play on a Pearl Jam record. And he's played some absolute stunners. And leave it to Matt to continue to push this boulder up the mountain, adjusting his beat. It's driving. He's willing the listener to follow him up the mountainside with more incredible drum fills to boot. And then you got Ed refraining the opening lines to the song, "You can be loved, but not feel love." And I'm going to make some metaphors here. But it feels like Ed's holding on to the reins of like this runaway horse-drawn carriage, you know, like in the old Westerns. And each band member is like a thoroughbred galloping, but someone's got to steer this thing. So why not Ed? And then finally, once free of that which chases us, because we're all in this carriage together, Mike is free to take us away to that special place that only Pearl Jam can take us. And when Andrew Watt talks about not ending the take until Mike finally opens his eyes again, this is what he's talking about. And every one of you out there who's seen this band live is already envisioning what this looks like right now as I'm speaking. And Ed continues underneath him. "You can be loved." Ed, in this song, everybody feels the message being conveyed. That music is the vehicle for the love that binds us. And I'll say as a quick epilogue here, the little musical interlude at the end is gorgeous. And I doubt we'll ever hear it live, but it's kind of like you're floating in an inner tube down a lazy river under the stars. And yeah,
that's be mighty. A good analogy.
Thank you. Be mighty, be humble, be mighty humble. And I think that's something that we all need to remind ourselves every now and again. So front to back. Yeah. 5. Sorry.
Boy.
Not sorry.
All right. We have one for the ages here.
We have one.
I have to say, you're on fire with these metaphors and the figurative language you're tying in here. Well done. Well done,
Paul. When we're talking, you know, lyrical themes, I have to elevate my game to match you. or try to, I should really be saying.
It's a low bar. But
you're busting out these $5 words, and I'm like, ascendancy? Okay.
That's a good
Do my best. What do you got?
Waiting for Stevie. You know, it's funny. Everyone keeps talking about like singles era Pearl Jam. To me, it feels more like a Soundgarden song than a singles era Pearl Jam song. Mm-hmm. I will admit, though, that wall of guitars at the beginning and the vocal harmonizing at the end in concert with Mike's blistering solo, you know, that is reminiscent, I would say, of early 10 era Pearl Jam. Stone even identified this song, though, as an unintentional Soundgarden tribute, which I thought was pretty cool. Jeff's bass is like thick. I mean, it is like molasses thick. And it's got this industrial groove, and it serves, I think, as a great bedrock for this amazing throwback sound. So I think in a lot of ways, this song is it's a portal into a sound that Pearl Jam has not really channeled in a long time.
Right.
And I think that nostalgia is and does elevate the song in Pearl Jam fans who have been with the band as long as we have. I wonder if newer listeners would have the same reaction to this song, but that's neither here nor there. In an interview with Howard Stern, Eddie said the song was about how music can like change your life and, you know, kind of lead you to your tribe. That's how he phrased it, which is interestingly enough, in many ways, the very same tale of the of Edward Louis Severson III, right? Mm. So it is very much that where he kind of slipped into this path of music helping him find his tribe. The song seems supposedly about a girl who doesn't really feel embraced or comfortable with her friends, and she seems to find solace, I guess, and a sense of belonging in experiencing live shows. So she finds her tribe that way. It's hard for me to not listen to the song and think that this is an anthem for so many Pearl Jam fans who have found their tribe, their strangest tribe, if you will, in the communal experience of seeing the band live. Now, we've spoken, Jason, to many folks who have not only made some of their most beloved lifelong friends at Pearl Jam shows over the years, and in some cases have revolved their lives around the band's touring schedule and music. This is their song. You know, this is a song for them, I think, in a lot of ways. I made an unrelated cinematic connection to Won't Tell in our last episode. I made that connection to the film Before Sunset, the Richard Linklater film Before Sunset, which I now think might be Jeff's best song after, I don't know, maybe Nothing Man. I'm not sure. But he played baritone guitar on that track. He wrote the lyrics and the music himself, more or less. I mean, Eddie kind of chimed in towards the end. Mm-hmm. And apparently this was inspired by a dream that he had featuring Joni Mitchell and Neil Young. Now, for Waiting for Stevie, I'm going to make a similar unrelated connection, but it will be a literary connection, not a cinematic connection. The book, The Outsiders, by Sylvia Eloise Hinton, S.E. Hinton, it's a masterpiece. It was written by a girl, a teenage girl, 15 or 16 years old, pardon me. She shortened her name at the time to S.E. Hinton because the publishers believed that the book would not be as successful if audiences knew that it was written by a teenage girl. So similar to like J.K. Rowling with Harry Potter. This effort to appeal to wider audiences, as sexist as it was, ultimately, I think, prevailed in helping this book reach the audience that it deserved. But there's a character in that book named Cherry Valance. And Cherry Valance belongs to an upper crust group that lives in this small town in like rural Oklahoma. And that group is kind of at odds with the poorer group. So these socially acceptable kids, socias as they're called, struggles. It's very much a West Side Story in the sense that there's like a poor versus rich dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And in the book, this girl, Cherry Valance, feels caught in the middle because she struggles to kind of find her tribe, essentially. So I'm gonna pull a quote from that book. She's talking to the main character named Pony Boy Curtis. And by the way, if you haven't seen the film, I think it came out in 1983, highly recommend it. It's very faithful to the book. Anyway, so she's having this conversation with a a greaser named Ponyboy. And Ponyboy kind of insinuates that the difference between socias and greasers is money. And she says, no, it's not just money. Part of it is, but not all. You greasers have a different set of values. You're more emotional. We're sophisticated, cool to the point of not feeling anything. Nothing is real with us. You know, sometimes I'll catch myself talking to a girlfriend and realize I don't mean half of what I'm saying. I don't really think a beer blast on the river bottom is super cool, but I'll rave about one to a girlfriend just to be saying something. I never really told anyone that. You're the first person I've ever really gotten through to. And then Ponyboy continues, she was coming through to me all right, probably because I was a greaser and younger. She didn't have to keep her guard up with me. And that's that wall. Mm-hmm. I think, in the same way that scene at the end of Before Sunset to me is Won't Tell, just personified in so many ways. I think that monologue from Cherry Valance in many ways, that is the character. You know what I mean? That's the character who personifies Waiting for Stevie in a lot of ways. This girl who really can't seem to connect with this group that she is told she's a part of and should continue to be a part of. And she's really searching for that tribe. So I found myself just, you know, really identifying the song with that perspective. And sometimes I like anchoring a lot of Eddie's lyrics and grounding them into a character, because quite frankly, you know, I think the band, that they're all very well read, and a lot of times they will do similar things. You know, they will kind of anchor music and lyrics to things that they've read that have inspired them. Not suggesting, obviously, that Waiting for Stevie has anything to do with The Outsiders, but I thought it was a cool parallel. I'll finish with this. So it was reported that between Running and Waiting for Stevie, we get that little snippet, that lazy river journey that you talked about underneath the stars. That was part, apparently, of an unfinished song that came from the first recordings in July of 2021. So the band apparently decided that they were just going to keep that as it was, and they just tagged it on. Now, the snippet, mind you, is gorgeous. It's like that ephemeral ending that concludes Waiting for Stevie's total runtime. So it's kind of like a prerequisite to view it within the context of this song rather than a separate track like the ones we had on Vitalogy. On one hand, I love that ending. It almost elevates Waiting for Stevie even higher than it already is. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that I almost wish they had finished that song, because I love the dynamics that are happening there. And I'd argue that if that ever came to fruition, it had the potential to be one of, if not the best song on this album. Alas, it will instead go down as one of those like little rare teases in Pearl Jam lore that we adore so much. But man, do I wish that they had pursued making that into a song, because it is so captivating. It's like, I'm on that river with them and I'm staring up at the stars and then I'm not there anymore. And it's like, well, wait a minute. We just got started. Anyway. So I'm going to give this song a 4.5, which is as high as I've gone on any song on this album so far, right. But that's a high accolade for a brand new song. Absolutely. Very impressive. Yeah, I think it's a tremendous tune, and it's going to be a fan favorite for a long time.
I hope somebody out there with some editing skills finds the Outsiders movie and cuts a music video to this song.
Hey, somebody's got an idea. There you go.
I don't have the time for that, but somebody does. All right, let's move on to the song that abruptly stops that little snippet, Running. So I did an instant reaction video to this song when it was released as a second single, and I had a hard time with it. And I think the biggest problem was that I was listening to it in Dolby Atmos, but without the right headphones, and it sounded really weird. I've since rectified that and listened many, many times. And as I predicted then, it certainly has grown on me. A quick number, originally titled Big Sandy Punk, and we know why. Another Jeff Baby, and it certainly has his fingerprints on it, along with friend of the show, Richard Stuverud. Rich confirming this is one of the demos that he and Jeff worked on two Januaries ago in San Diego. Mm-hmm. So you've got Jeff's distorted bass line. It really sets the tone. It's not quite go fast, but it's quick and sharp and punchy. And then you got Mike following Jeff with the Furious Power Chords, while Stone kind of focuses attention on kind of just stabbing a couple of notes over and over again before it gives a little bendy bend right before Ed joins the fray. So Ed's vocal melody pretty cool. It kind of weaves in and out of the music in a quite brilliant way. He's very adept at this. He's always been really good at, you know, making his voice feel like just another instrument. And obviously there are some songs in the catalog that are more singer-songwriter style, including the next one, where it's more about using the, using the music as a canvas on which to paint, you know? But here, he's firmly kind of amongst the music. And for this style, I think it's well-suited. And I'll add that upon first listen of this, I was almost taken aback by how much, you know, within the music he sounded. But that may have been just my funky mix. So disregard. Now, if you had told me that I was missing a Pearl Jam song with gang vocals in my life 6 months ago, I'd probably have cocked an eyebrow and said, I'm good. But, you know, maybe I just think of a certain style of music when I think of gang vocals. You know, having heard how it's used here, I think it's pretty cool. And kudos to Smitty for his chops, Mark Smith, the band's manager. I think it adds a little bit of grit and maybe, and you know, this might sound a little bit cheesy, but community to the themes herein. Now, we did a whole show on our top five bridges in the catalog. It's a section of a song that we think Pearl Jam absolutely nails, so much so that we might even do a part two at some point. This bridge is the best part of the song. It's huge. It elevates. And no pun intended, though, with you know, the lift off and take off lyrics. I love the little digital pick scrape things happening, you know? Like, that for me is how you properly utilize that kind of studio magic. And it's similar to how they sprinkle that magic dust on Dark Matter. And then straight into that blistering guitar lead. And the band just going double time. And those drum fills that Matt's doing there, as impressive as Ed basically blowing out his vocal cords. I mean, I haven't heard him sound that pissed since, what, Blood?
Yeah, it's been a while.
And I don't think he sounds as visceral in Mind Your Manners as he does here.
No, I was about to reference that one, yeah.
Now, lyrically, it's got some really cool turns of phrase in rhyme schemes. You know, I'm feeling done in, it's rather stunning. And then the last lines of that chorus there, lost in the tunnel and the tunnel's getting funneled like the sewage in the plumbing because we left the fucking water running. Hard to say. Again, maybe my brain is too obtuse to understand what Ed's really going for here. So I'm going to defer to you, Paul, when it comes to the real lyrical themes here. But it feels like being pissed at those who control the narrative, like those who control what we're allowed to do, implying that personal liberty is limited to those who are selfish and self-righteous. You know, all this I can get behind. So if that's right, then I like this song more. But I'm not sure there are enough lines that grab me like the aforementioned ones to make me feel like this song is super strong. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a brevity thing because Animal is super concise, but its point is well made, I think. Mm-hmm. So when you write a punk song, you are intending for the song to be direct, simple, and powerful. And this song is all of those things. And while it's grown on me, and I will pogo like crazy when I see it live, I don't think it's a classic, simply very good. So I'm going to go 3.5.
Okay. I will agree. This song did not immediately grab me the way that, say, Super Blood Wolf Moon did. Now, that's a song that I think serves as like a measuring stick for Pearl Jam dad punk at its finest. But after spending more time with this song, I'm really starting to feel like it's more than just a cromulent punk rocker. And it actually might occupy the 1B spot to Super Blood's 1A.
Did you say cromulent?
I did. But I think it might actually occupy the 1B spot to Super Blood's 1A for me in that bucket, at least. It's the fastest and the shortest song on this record. And that dictator, love-hater, like gang callback that they got going on, the lyrics, it's infectious. And I think it's going to play big time live. The bridge, you already said it. It's big. It's huge. It's outstanding. It's very uniquely original in the catalog, too. And that's what I love about some of these bridges. You know, when you think about some of these songs, and we talked about a lot of them on Versus, those bridges are some standout moments in the catalog. And I think this is going to join them in the pantheon of like great Pearl Jam bridges. Jeff came with the bulk of this song in place before they worked it over as a band. And I think this final result really has that punk rock anthem of a generation feel to it, where so many of us in this country feel like we're just constantly running to keep pace, only to realize that we're essentially running in place. And as we struggle to just get ahead while this dictator and love hater keeps us in a tunnel swimming upstream in the sewage that he or I guess they, I don't know, keep flushing because we, by the way, and I emphasize the we here, left the water running. And that, I think, is ultimately the rub here. Unlike so many of those punk rock anthems of the 70s and 80s that rallied against the establishment Eddie acutely points out what I think is a very salient signal here. We have to take some accountability here because we kind of let this condition emerge. We elected it for ourselves. And I think that is what makes this song different and unique when you try to pair it or compare it, I should say, with or to other big, you know, bold punk rock anthems from, you know, the Ramones or the Misfits or any of these timeless bands that were kind of really standing out at the time and just counterculture. But I'm a big fan. I'm with you with the rating. I think it's a 3.5. But it's growing on me more and more every time I listen to it. I would not be surprised if as I listen to it more, it very easily ages into a 4 for me. I enjoy it.
I love that you say that because, you know, when we heard the first like little snippet back forever ago, you were very underwhelmed.
I was, but like
so
I
to hear you kind of come like, around a little bit.
Well, a song like Ghost, for example, is a great example of a track that really didn't. I had trouble accessing it. I had trouble connecting with it, and for me, that was a 2 when I first heard it. But it has really aged into a 3, and it's kind of like topped out there for me. You know what I mean? This is a song that very quickly has aged into 3.5, and I can see how the more and more I listen to it. I'm starting to look forward to it, you know? So to me, that's a sign that we're at 3.5. We're already nudging our way towards 4. It's just going to take a little bit more time, I imagine.
Yeah.
We'll see. I don't know.
I think I'm there with you that it's approaching 4 level. I think maybe even Dark Matter is starting to approach 4 level.
I already had it eventually.
I know you do. I know you do. But you know, we did the Gigaton, a year later episode, and there were some interesting little shifts there.
There were changes.
Maybe there were a year from now. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on to the next song. It's Something Special. Now, this is probably the most divisive song on the record. It's chimey. It's schmaltzy, it's pretty, and it's very specific in its message. Now, I get it. Especially if you don't have kids, this song means very little to you. However, I do have kids, and I don't mind some schmaltz every now and again, as evidenced by my love for Future Days. Now, this one is co-written by Josh Klinghoffer. Has a really loose feel, jangly, like it was a first take on the last day of recording, and they felt like they had the record done. Like, hey, what about we just like record this one? And it turned out in a way that they wanted to include it. I don't have inside info that that's what happened. It just kind of feels that way. Okay. And I think it's a good thing. Like when you feel like you've got nothing to prove, you're loose, you know, you let your hair down, you play something that just comes naturally from the heart.
You literally it's just described Bugs. Got nothing to lose. It comes naturally. Just screw it. We're putting it on the album.
Well, for me, it's kind of like when you're doing like that one last hand at the casino, you know, when you're already up a few hundred bucks and you don't really care if you win or lose that last $10 hand because you've already had a great time at the table. You're drinking, you're shopping stores with total strangers, and yeah, you're up. And look at that, you won the hand. Like that's what this song feels like to me. Like I don't need it, but I have it. Uh-huh. Ed feels like he's singing as naturally as is possible for him, and that's not surprising considering the song is an ode to his two daughters, Olivia and Harper. Now the question is though, is it too cheesy? Is it too direct? And most importantly, is it too personal? And I will ask you, if you vehemently say no, I ask you, would you say the same thing about a song like Bushleaguer or 7 o'clock? Two incredibly direct and specific songs about specific people that have aged in ways that only you know.
Okay.
And by the way, I'm not trying to compare Ed's love for his daughters to his contempt for either former president. But listen, as a
mutually
rock song
exclusive.
With a lot of country, exactly, very mutually exclusive. Now, it is a rock song with a lot of country flavor. It's a fun track with some fine pop elements. And while I am father of two kids, they aren't daughters. So lines like "You're not the type to need a man" don't really hit the same for me, even if I appreciate the sentiment. It's a fine song, and I hope to hear it live. But while Ed's daughters are undoubtedly special, I'm not sure the song is. Ed, please don't send me any hate mail. I'm going to go 2.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like the way you phrase that, though. Yeah. I like the way you phrase that. Something special. Here's a question for you. Is this the sequel to Around the Bend?
Yeah. It very much came to mind. Like,
yeah? Okay.
Almost like you did like a, you know, the Star Wars thing where it's like all of a sudden Anakin's grown up kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's just a thought, a whimsical thought. But every setback, not but a chance to grow. I love the growth mindset element of this song, you know?
Absolutely. That's the best part of this.
Yeah. So there's a story. I forget the rabbi's name that tells it, but he says this is the, you know, he talks about a lobster and he describes the situation where you have a lobster, and what makes a lobster unique is that a lobster essentially is this, you know, sea creature that discards its shell as it grows because it no longer fits. So it discards its shell and now it's vulnerable, right? And so it hides under a rock and it slowly grows a new one. And then as it grows and grows and grows, it discards the next shell. And it goes through this routine over and over and over and over again. And the difference is that if the lobster was a human, every time that shell became uncomfortable, it would go see the doctor, it would get a Percocet, get a Valium, and it would just stay in its shell, and it would not grow. You know what I mean? And the idea is that it's the discomfort that ultimately serves as a stimulus for growth. And these are not my ideas, by the way. I should have the rabbi's name on hand.
No, but it's apt. There's a
YouTube clip. Just type in rabbi and lobster and I'm sure it'll come up. Anyway, point is, this song I think does a great job. I love how early that idea shows up, this idea of a growth mindset in the song, because if there's one thing you want to teach your children, whether you have a daughter or a son, it's to have a growth mindset. Afraid to fail, same as afraid to try. Right? These are the days to accept all the invites. The messaging here for me is really, really strong, especially for a generation that's so hyper-focused on image and Instagram posts and TikTok and how they're being perceived by others through social media. You know, this line here, the twisted wheel, you know, it keeps on spinning round. Bet on yourself, your number's so special. That roulette wheel of life and this plea from a father to a daughter or to a child to bet on yourself, you know, bet on yourself. It's a really heartfelt ballad. It's a lovely father to daughter message. As a father with a young daughter, this song continues to resonate with me. Yes, it is a little schmaltzy at times, well, maybe overly sentimental, or I don't know what words you want to call it, corny, I don't know. But let's take a moment to appreciate something. There is a symmetry, okay? There is a symmetry in seeing Eddie as a father and recalling back to the Eddie that we used to know and the tragic story of songs like Alive and songs like Release and thinking, and even the ending of Earthling. Okay. And you think about, you know, that to me felt like that was like full circle. Little did I know that in reality, it could be this song that's really full circle, because to watch him evolve from that tragic story of his own relationship with his father, estranged from his life, and to come to this place, of relishing the job of fatherhood that he does for free, as he says in the song, because he sees what every father should see, that his children are so damn special. It's a stark contrast to Alive, to Release, and definitely to Father's Son. And I love it for that. I'm giving it a 3. It's not something that, you know, I'm happy to just kind of ride with the cool little, you know, sentimental jangle that it is. And it's his daughter. I think it's Olivia's favorite song. I think I read that in an interview at some point in time. Oh, okay. As it should be, you know, I think it's beautiful. Yeah. So it's a lot of fun in that regard. I'm not saying it's going to go down as like a classic. And I don't necessarily think he was trying to write some, you know, deep ode, you know, this is Pearl Jam's Candle in the Wind or something like that. I mean, it was you know, it was something that I think was in the moment, and I like the jangle element to it, because there's a level of innocence and a level of, I don't want to say childlike innocence because that's not true, but I could see, like, you know how you do like a Pearl Jam for babies and they get the little xylophones or whatever. This is a song that would play well there, or like, you know, there's I used to take my daughter to this, it was like a music class called Ladybug Music. So I'd bring her there with other moms and dads and we listen to music. Like, this is the kind of song that I could see. I mean, minus the word damn, but I could see like somebody playing, you know what I mean? Playing along.
Yeah.
It's fun. It has its place. I enjoy it.
Yeah, I absolutely believe it has its place. I think if it was a little less specifically about, like if it was less obvious about how it's specifically about his daughters, like if you made it a little bit more, not generic, but you know what I mean? Like if like lines that I mentioned about, you know, don't need a man kind of thing. It's like, okay, I get it. Love it. But like,
you know, what's
a little bit more,
is it just me? Or are you noticing that there seems to be this exalted reverence for the children, but there's a lot of songs about what seems like a relationship and strife.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this, it's a strange dichotomy because it's almost like, I think I was expecting more of the same when it came to that, you know, but I think the cool thing is
like the themes
that,
you mean across the album?
Themes across the album. Yeah. There's just a wide spectrum of themes, whether you view it as like generational strife or political strife or personal strife.
And well, that's then, the beauty, like, of Ed's lyrics, right? They can apply it to many different ways.
There's a lot of application to it. And so I appreciate the versatility.
Yeah. There was somebody who wrote a review. Thank you very much. Who said that he thought, or he, the way he took it, what I say he, they, I don't know, that it felt like one long concept of a divorce happening in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, Jesus. Okay. So I might have to go back and re-listen with that fully in my mind. With that, yeah, exactly. I know, right? For everybody involved. But anyways, that was just an interesting angle that was thrown in my way. Anywho, let's move on to the second to last track, the penultimate track, Got to Give. All right. Now, I have been harsh a few times across these two episodes reviewing Dark Matter, but from here on out, I'm going to level with you. There is little that I don't love. Now, Got to Give opens with a very pretty finger-plucked acoustic passage, complete with what sounds like synthetic flutes or something. Like, someone's going to correct me on that instrument, but it sounds like something you'd hear on a Zeppelin record, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing this was something that Ed was kind of messing around with, and Andrew was like, let's just slap that at the beginning of something. And they did, and it's nice. And then this song really begins, and God, Matt's drums sound so good on this record. And while it's not like Neil Peart level difficult, he graciously just rolls right into the main riff and rhythm. Now, I love the stereo cowboy chord riffage left and right with an aggressively strummed acoustic right down the middle. You can really feel the Neil Young here, and I'm loving it. Mm-hmm. And like I've said it before, and I'll say it again, dynamics, people. This record has so many dynamics. And how about this? In a record full of amazing bass playing, this song is my favorite of Jeff's. He's like full John Paul Jones on this one. And I cannot wait to watch his fingers at work live on this song. Then you have Ed. I mean, the way that he accentuates his vocal delivery as he enters the third stanza is great, considering that the main riff and groove carries on for a while. So you got to change things up to keep things interesting. And he adds a little extra oomph that emphasizes that line there. What is it? And there I am, just picking up the parts. And he does it again a couple of times later as well. And then you got the chorus, brilliantly goes back and forth between two chords. Again, tension building, because all you want to do is resolve back to the main chord of the song. And not only do we get back to that in a cathartic manner, but you've got this gorgeous ascending guitar lead that sounds like it's taking the baton from Ed out of the chorus. And what's great about the chorus as well are these little hitches, like these little full band stutters everyone is doing. It's like if you had the entire band kind of funneled into an acoustic guitar and you did that little like strum thing, like, maybe it's hard to articulate, but I love how it adds some flavor to a relatively straightforward chorus chord progression. And I feel like I'm repeating myself, but the bridge, my God, the bridge, you know, talk about a downshift, but immediately you can feel the tension building back up. You know, Matt delicately playing across the kit, the finger-picked sparkly guitars. And then Ed is willing us to follow him through this musical forest. He sees a clearing, and we just got to trust him. And then our trust is rewarded with a double time elevation. Like the sun is beating down on us. You know, and it's the most beautiful bit of wilderness you've ever seen. Like picture any one of those majestic scenics from the show Yellowstone if you need help with a visual. And then Ed soaring again, finding the limits of what his voice can handle while happily doing so. And the piano, dancing around the band, driving through that three chord progression as if their lives depended on it. You know, the guitar is being struck so hard that the low E strings are just like bending out of tune for a split second. Like that's joy right there.
It is.
And the guitar lead climbing, magical, Paul, this magical outro. And that last E chord, it rings out like in Parting Ways, but without the despair of separation. Like instead, it's a celebration of what we can accomplish together. Like this is like the relationship in the aforementioned Parting Ways. But if the couple decided to fight for each other one last time instead of acquiescing, love is hard. And no one said it's easy. And Ed masterfully sprinkles many metaphors to relay the precarious nature of love that could fall apart at any moment. And some of these lines are just vintage Ed too, like the opening stanza. Stormy seas behind your eyes. The dark moon is setting on your cheap disguise. Whoever said love is a compromise knew you. Brilliant.
Yeah, that might be the most pointed line in the catalog, by the way. That is
it's so good.
Yeah.
Something tells me the way that this song ends, that the relationship does turn out all right. I just, everything about this is just situated just so, and it's near flawless for me. It's a 4.5.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean,
love it.
That's interesting. Apparently this is Jeff's favorite song on the record.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of shades of The Who and Bob O'Reilly, especially the bridge and the outro. It's a big song. Lyrically, it actually makes me think a lot of that Tonic song, If You Could Only See. Do you remember that song in the 90s?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know if you know the backstory around that song, but the singer at the time, he had met this woman and she was a little bit older than him and he was absolutely convinced that she was the one. And his parents were not sold at all. And so they were really discouraging him from pursuing this much longer. And he wrote the song essentially as like this protest, you know, saying, if you could only see, you know, how blue her eyes when she says, I love you. She loves me, I think that's how the line goes. And of course, the irony is that she ends up cheating on him with her personal trainer or something. Or maybe not, maybe not. I know that she leaves him, right? Yeah. Maybe I'm thinking of that Stabbing Westward song. I forget what that one was too, but in this particular instance, you know, it's interesting when I'm looking at these lyrics, that was the callback for me. That was where I made that connection where, you know, and the figurative language, I mean, you cited so many examples, so I'm not just going to regurgitate them all, but the song's just loaded with them. So for me, it's a 4. I completely agree.
Cool. All right. Sounds like we're fairly in lockstep there.
I think so.
Well, here we go. Final track of the album. Setting Sun. The final track of the album, you know, these songs are always interesting because you don't know how they're going to choose to make their final statement. You know, it could be naked and emotive, like Release and Indifference. It could be powerfully anthemic, like Parting Ways or Inside Job. It could be simple, sweet, and feel like a warm blanket, like Around the Bend or Future Days. And so the band said, yes, we'll do all of the things. Yeah, it's as unique an opening to a Pearl Jam song as I've ever heard. It's untraditional percussion with the bongos. You got synth horns and acoustic guitar playing very percussively, which I think it sounds like Ed's Gibson J200, by the way, and upon first listen there, I think I'm right because Zane Lowe, the interview that he did with the band recently, shows at the very end Josh playing Ed's J200 while they play this song to close the video out. So it pretty much sits in this tranquil pocket until a wild electric guitar appears and slides us into a new direction. You got the guitar strumming comes a little bit more pronounced, and Ed sounds a little bit more assured as he sings, you know, had dreams to you, I would belong. And upon first listen, it was at this point that I felt like I might be a changed person by the end of this song. And by the time the second chorus rolls around, I am now convinced I will be changed by the end of this song. And then you got the outro. I mean, it feels like without realizing it, we've traveled like 5,000 feet into the atmosphere. Like if you take off in a plane and kind of zone out for a minute or two and then remember where you are, you look out the plane's window and recall how insignificant all your problems are with the world below, because like the buildings and the cars and everything is just so tiny and inconsequential. So
tiny, right?
Yeah. Like this song is doing that for me. It's taking me to a place that I didn't know that I could access within myself. And then Matt enters proper, along with a full complement of electric guitar. And Ed matches their intensity, singing the refrain that lives with me for hours at a time. If you could see what I see now, you'd find a way to stay somehow. And the guitars are ducking in and over themselves like dolphins playfully racing with each other in the open water. Like Ed is in the mood, man. He's in the mood. He's bearing it all, but it's not the scorn, like despondent or beaten soul bearing from 30 years ago. It's a wisdom befitting a call to action to not let our hope die. That it is our obligation to lift each other up so that our future feels as focused and hopeful as this music is. And as the band drifts into the background, Ed makes one final request for us to not fade. Like, make it count, he's saying. Let's make this life count. During my initial listen at the record store listening party, I wrote in big letters in my little journal there, bring it on under this song. And that's how I feel. It's the second five on this record for me.
Whoa, you went there. Okay.
Yep.
Interesting. All right. Yeah, I didn't think you'd go that far, but.
I did.
You did. It's interesting how many parallels you drew to Parting Ways with Got to Give. Whereas so many listeners have drawn that parallel with this song. At least from what I've read, I think it's a perfect closer to the record. Sonically, I think it runs parallel in mood and tone to a song like Long Road, which interestingly enough is a popular opener. So I wonder how this song would fare in the same slot to open a show, but I think it's probably something that would close a set rather than open one. You know, this song, what's interesting is you listen to what Eddie's singing. He sings, we could become one last setting sun or be the sun at the break of dawn. Let us not fade. It's a ballad that, the general consensus seems to be that it has that Parting Ways feel to it, but I think that there's a lot of like Into the Wild flourishes when you listen to it. I don't know if you got that as well.
I can feel that,
but you know, you did a great job referencing a lot of the figurative language here as well. You know, had dreams to you, I would belong. Had the dream, you would say, stay with me till kingdom come. Turns out forever has come and gone. Am I the only one hanging on? And that line really stuck with me because I think that there's a bookend feel to it when you think about what we just talked about last week with Scared of Fear. If you could see what I see now, you'd find a way to stay somehow. Hit harder when you think, you know, it hits hard, man. It does, because the opening of this record, I talked about this generational reflection and social commentary on the Seattle scene and what happened to it. And these are the last ones standing when you think about it, you know what I mean? We've lost a lot of important figures from that era. We recently lost Chris. We obviously in the '90s, we lost Kurt, and Andy, we lost Lane Staley in 2002. And Pearl Jam is kind of
Mark Lanegan.
What remains? Yeah, we lost Mark, you know. So and I think that this record, in a lot of ways, from beginning to end, it does kind of touch on that. You know, there's you talked about mortality, right? I think in some ways the band's thinking about not just their own personal mortality, but the band's mortality, which I know is something that nobody listening to this wants to think about. But I think it's hard not to start thinking about it when this record very, very much seems to be on the surface level addressing it. You know, there is a loneliness in seeing so many before you fall away. And, you know, recognizing that that forever has come and that you are the only ones hanging on. And wanting to say, like, if you could see what I see now, you would find a way to stay. And it's a testament to the will of all of these men to anchor their lives in the people that they love, not just the music or not just, you know, substance, which was so often abused by their counterparts. So I think it's important to recognize that as a closer, you know, this song is a reflection on the journey that has transpired to get here. And there's a lot of introspection happening in this record, and it kind of harkens back to those earlier records where so much was about the road ahead, you know, and we referenced this in a line earlier on this record, you know, the horizon and the road ahead. And now we're kind of approaching that horizon, you know, we're approaching the end of the road. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, they're not spring chickens anymore. So, would it be cool if they were like, okay, well, you know, we're going to tour a heck of a lot less and make like 5 more albums. I mean, that would be awesome, you know, but I mean, realistically, that's not who they are. Like, they literally record records because it gave them an excuse to go play live. And for all the production value that went into this record, it's designed, it's made, it's ready made to be played live. Whereas so much of what the Beatles were doing was not, you know what I mean? It was very much the studio exercises, and it would be very difficult, at least it would have been at that time, to replicate so many of those sounds live, if at all. So I don't think that's going to be Pearl Jam's trajectory. You know, that's not their path. So when it becomes clear that being on the road, like that grind is something that is not fulfilling, or it's something that they just don't have it in them to do, I think that, you know, it's going to call into question whether or not they can. Although, you know, Kevin Martin told us this, and, you know, last I checked, he's on a bill for here touring with Bush.
He's still playing.
Yeah, exactly. Which, hey, I mean, that's amazing. I mean, obviously, who wants less of that? Not me. I'm here for it. Right? Exactly. I'm here for it too.
It's shades of Kiss and Motley Crue, where it's like the final tour. 20 years goes by.
Exactly. But you just want the best for all of them. You know what I mean? Literally all of them. They've given so much of themselves. And at the end of the day, having the chance to get to know many figures from the scene and folks in the adjacent community, you start to care a lot about them as people, and you start thinking you've got to do what's best for you. You know what I mean? Because what's ultimately best for you is best for the greater community. So Setting Sun, I do not think this is the last Pearl Jam album in the catalog. Even if I will acknowledge that if it was, there is a level of poetic culmination to it. You know what I mean?
It'd be a hell of a way to go if it was.
It would be. It would be, but I hope it's not. And I've not received any inclination from anything the band has communicated that this is it, even if there has
been. Stone hasn't texted you?
No, except that'll never happen. But yeah, there's no, there's insinuations that, you know, there. I think Eddie said that, you know, maybe we got one or two left in us. But
in tongue in cheek. Yeah,
exactly. Or maybe not. I don't know. But I mean, again, like I said, you know. So I think it's a fine finish to the record in a lot of ways, and a perfect bookend to the song that opens it. So I'm going to go ahead and rate this one a 3.5, only because I know we're a bit of a divide there. I like it. I like it a lot. It's probably closer to a 4. Maybe it's a 4 for me. I don't know. It's probably a 4. I'll give it a 4. I'll give it a 4.
Okay. Well,
look at me waffling already.
But I really do appreciate and love that there is that bookend feel of Scared of Fear to this song, not only because of the Setting Sun reference in Scared of Fear, but that you can make it about a personal relationship as well as a relationship to a scene and a group of people and colleagues and contemporaries. And like, guys, if you could see what amazing things are happening here, don't put that thing down. Don't do that thing. Stay, come over here, hang out, like time machine stuff. Well, do we have an overall grade for this bad boy? An average score, if you will?
I'd have to do the numbers, but almost everything I gave was, I mean, there's a couple of threes. It's we're probably hovering in that four range, I guess.
Yeah. For me, it's a four as well.
Yeah. That's about where I'm at. So,
yeah.
That's when you think about it across the spectrum of the catalog, I mean, how many bands are making records at this stage of their career? And fans
34 years in, man.
That's what I mean. Like, typically speaking, I mean, it's like, hey, you know, first couple are fours and fives, and then everything after that is in the 2 to 3 range. You know what I mean? So, to be in a place where, you know, some of us are saying this might be one of their best records in a generation.
A while.
I mean, it's in a while for sure. I'd say we're very fortunate.
100%. Before we get out of here, give me a bold prediction for this tour.
A bold prediction for this tour. I'm tempted to say that We Hear Comes Then Goes, only because I feel like there's a level of introspection that's an inherent part of what's being communicated lyrically here that I feel like Eddie's ready to kind of navigate those big feelings in a larger setting. Mm-hmm. You know, if there was a time where I never thought we'd hear Ark, it was almost like it was a foregone conclusion that there was a reverence to the, you know, the friends that were lost. And then it was played, albeit in a solo setting, but still it came out. So I think
it was played across that tour.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was in the right.
It's still a surprise.
It was a surprise. Yeah.
Nine times. So, you know why? Because it's not on any bootlegs.
Yeah, that's probably
why. It was removed from all the shows that it was a part of.
Well, there you go. And you can't really do that though with Comes the Ghost. Like, you're not going to pull that off a boot. I mean,
you can,
but I don't know if they would. So is that my bull prediction? I mean, that's one of them. I think, the other one is that, I think that we will get one marathon show on this tour. I know that they've been conscious about compressing things and playing shorter shows, which I totally understand. But I think there's going to be one date here for whatever reason that gets like a sit down acoustic set and then like two encores that are like five songs each or something like that. I just have a feeling we're going to get one, you know, a throwback old school show. I do not think we're going to get an album played in its entirety like we did in the past.
Some people on our Discord will be very sad to hear that.
Yeah. Well, what do I know? But.
I'm going to say two things, and that is that I think every song from the album gets played at least by the second leg of the US tour, which will be August.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's a good call.
I think...
I don't know if it's bold, though. Is that bold?
It's bold. It's bold adjacent.
Okay.
it's bold light.
it's the
I think this will be the most complete Pearl Jam we've ever experienced. I think that the fall of 2023 shows had signs of what this band is capable of, if not for COVID fucking things up. But I think the new songs will sound so great and in and amongst the rest of the catalog that it will this tour will just feel bigger and better than we've heard in our memory. And maybe I'm a homer, but I think it's just going to be a different level than we are accustomed to seeing. And I think the guys might agree with that because they think that they are playing better than they ever have. I said last year that the Austin shows, and even at the previous year on the Gigaton tour, that the Sonics just sounded incredible. It just sounded good. So I think this might be the most compelling tour we've ever had since. Memory serves. So
that's
what I'm going to say. Well, I promised you guys we'd give give the answer to our Patreon giveaway winner, it's over there. I can't get it, but it's on the screen right now by the magic of editing. The Dark Matter LP, crystal clear vinyl, the whole kit and caboodle. The winner of April's Patreon giveaway is Danielle Hayes. Congratulations to you, my friend.
Congratulations, so, Daniel.
We will send an email send it to you. So congrats. Yay.
Amazing.
There you go, guys. That is the episode. We hope you've enjoyed our Dark Matter review, front and back. Again, if you are interested in more of us, which is a bold take in and of itself, you can go ahead and join our Patreon. Link is on the screen right now. Link is in the bio of everything. Extra content, video and audio. And like I said, monthly giveaways. Or you can buy a shirt if you would like. Some pretty cool designs, I have to say so myself. And the simplest thing you could do, the easiest thing to do that we really do appreciate is on the screen right now. Like and subscribe to this video and channel. Hit the bell for notifications. And if you're listening to us but not watching us, Paul?
Just feed that algorithm. Rate, review, subscribe. Whatever podcast platform you use. That's what we need. That's what it wants.
All right, guys. Well, we will see you next week with another fabulous episode, I assure you, to quote the Clerks movie. As I lose control of the end of the episode. And until then, you've been listening to and watching State. No, I almost messed it up.
Are you stealing my line? You stealing my line?
Just do it.
The State of Love and Trust.